Professor Michael Baker was on Checkpoint earlier this evening talking about a possible new 7-level COVID alert system. And there's lots of other questions we wanted to put to him tonight, or you wanted to put to him. He's with us now. Good evening, Michael.
Kia ora, Karen.
Lots of questions for you, so shall I just go straight into it?
Sure.
Okay, can you please ask Professor Baker, what's the story as far as mask wearing goes if you're fully vaccinated? Should we all still be wearing them regardless of our vaccination status? That's from Geraldine.
Yes. Well, look, you can still transfer the virus to other people and infect them even if you're fully vaccinated. The vaccine is very good at protecting you from serious illness and death, but it's not quite as good at stopping you from being infected. Of course, if you're in a situation like New Zealand where there isn't circulating virus, it won't matter. But if you're in some parts of the world where there's a lot of circulating virus, you might still pick up the virus and unwittingly infect other people if you weren't wearing a mask.
Yes, what do you think of this Freedom Day in the UK on the 19th of July? No masks required.
Well, it seems like a fairly high-risk experiment that they're performing on particularly the youth of the UK. I mean, in a way, it's shades of going back to their original herd immunity from infection model, which they had right at the start and was a disaster. The only difference now, of course, is they have got fairly high vaccine coverage of the older, more vulnerable populations, so there'll be fewer deaths and hospitalizations. But they're still expecting up to 100,000 cases a day as this progresses, and potentially several thousand people going into hospital every day, which will put huge pressure on the NHS, which has still barely recovered from their previous two huge waves. And in addition, this process could lead to several million young people getting infected with the virus. And some of them, quite a high proportion of them, will get long COVID and quite serious effects. And of course, a small number will also die.
Gee, it's a risky business. This is a question from Alan. What's the optimum time to leave between the first and second Pfizer shots? Thanks, Alan.
Yes. Well, officially it's 3 weeks. It's certainly been found that if you delay the second dose up to 12 weeks, you get a much bigger immune response, so more antibodies are generated. So there is some theoretical benefit from having a longer interval, but it's being left open in New Zealand that 3 weeks is recommended, but extending it to 3 months will be fine. I don't think we have an official policy in New Zealand for delaying that second dose.
Nick Bevan says, can you please ask Michael Baker if he thinks the word compulsory for mask wearing would have a better uptake and understanding than mandatory? Both seem to have equal legal standing, but is it possible that compulsory is a better understood term when seeking full compliance, especially in the younger generation? And he says, in Wellington, mandatory means a bespoke menswear shop.
Yes, that's true. Look, I'm not sure. How young people are understanding particular words in terms of how assertive they sound, like to be obeyed or could be ignored. So I think that would be an area for some research to understand how best to frame this. I mean, no one likes the idea that of making things compulsory or mandatory unless it's really necessary. But if we look at the history of a lot of public health interventions, now people wouldn't question probably putting your child in a safe seat in a car, for instance, to reduce their risk of being injured in a car crash, but or obviously safety belts and helmets and so on. But initially people did resist these innovations, and now they're considered standard practice. So I think a lot of the same principles now apply to protecting the people around you from infection.
Okay, and Yvonne says, the outbreak of COVID-19 in New South Wales started, I believe, with a taxi driver. Given that, why aren't taxi drivers included in essential worker vaccine rollout?
Yes, well, I think it was actually a designated driver who transported returning air crew in Sydney. So I don't think it was a regular taxi driver. This was someone who we would classify as a border worker and they should have been vaccinated and they should have been wearing a mask. So this is really quite a serious breach in their system in Sydney. And I think it's a lesson for New Zealand as to why we are making it mandatory for all border workers to be vaccinated or redeployed.
Mike says, is Michael Baker disappointed with the pace of the vaccine rollout, and does he think, what does he think the barriers are?
I'm not overly concerned at the moment. I mean, we have to remember, I should say the barrier is the supply of vaccine. I mean, New Zealand's negotiated to get enough Pfizer vaccine for the whole country by the end of the year, but it is, as we know, coming in instalments. It's a just-in-time system. And obviously the quantities are going to increase rapidly from now on. But we have to remember that by the end of the year, if we have a fully vaccinated population, we will be in a very privileged position at a global level because still the bulk of people globally will not be vaccinated at that point. But at the moment, obviously we are behind some high-income countries that were at the front of the queue for various reasons. But we have, I think, or we're close to vaccinating the critical group for New Zealand, which is all the border workers, and then obviously working for the other two priority groups, who we hopefully will get fully vaccinated in the medium term.
Yes, we're coming up to July 28th, and for 2 million New Zealanders, that's Group 4. Now, this particular group, they're being asked to register and then they'll be contacted. And Nick asks, oh, sorry, Sam in Auckland asks this question, should the Ministry of Health centralise the process rather than leaving it to DHBs? Because this may mean a real crashing of systems on the 28th of July, registering for a shot.
Yes, well, look, we have got a national immunisation register, I think it's the National Immunisation Solution it's called now, which is meant to track and manage the vaccination process or who's been vaccinated nationwide. So I don't think there are separate systems for that at each DHB, but I know some aspects are being managed by individual DHBs. So yes, I mean, as we know, the New Zealand health system is being reorganised to make it far more consistent nationally, and I think we're seeing one of the benefits of that, or one of the reasons for that at present.
This texter asks, Oxford University is looking into ivermectin as a COVID-19 treatment. Ivermectin is not gaining mainstream approval yet. There is evidence that it is effective, cheap, and most importantly, already approved as a licensed and safe drug, but it hasn't been through the clinical trials. Please, could this option be given some discussion? Do you know about this particular drug?
Yeah, I know it's been talked about a lot. My general view is that because tens of thousands of drugs are being looked at in terms of their role in treating COVID-19. So there's huge benefits for researchers in demonstrating effectiveness. So I don't think that any potential drug is being ignored in that process. And I know that ivermectin has repeatedly been mentioned to me for over a year. So I'm just assuming that it has been fully evaluated, and I'm not actually aware of where the trials are with that particular drug.
Okay, and this person wants to know about the variants of concern, as the World Health Organization has labelled them, the Alpha, Beta, Delta and Gamma. Why do they spread so quickly?
This is natural selection happening before our very eyes, because when you think about it, the virus is infecting, countless numbers of people and cells, and the sheer force of infection is enormous. So the viruses keep mutating, and most of the new mutations don't give any advantage. But if they do, particularly if they make the virus more infectious, those viruses will leave more copies of themselves in the next generation, and so it goes on. And so inevitably, over time, we'll see more infectious variants favoured. And that's what's happened with these major variants of concern. The other criteria for being a variant of concern, not just transmissibility, but also if it causes more hospitalisation and mortality, if it affects the accuracy of testing, and also if it provides any escape from the protection provided by vaccines. And all of these things are relative, so it may be just small benefits for the virus, but it does affect these essential activities that will impact on its ability to be controlled. So at the moment, we've got 4 or 5 actual variants of concern that people, as you say, we're working through the Greek alphabet, and then there are these variants of interest, which is a longer list of virus variants that have accumulated quite a few mutations that makes them more worrying, but they haven't yet shown that they're significantly more dangerous.
Oh, I think I got the name of that drug wrong. Ivermectin?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that, yeah. Oh, that's all we've got time for, Michael. I know there's plenty of other questions, and I'm actually going to email you one from a person who wanted a little a more fully comprehensive answer about ME and chronic fatigue sufferers. So I'll email you that, and I'll get back to that person via their text number. So thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, great to talk, Karen.
Cheers. That's epidemiologist Professor Michael Baker.